Hello. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Also cool, I think, despite everything. We've just had a talk with another friend, Ukrainian friend, and we were discussing the depths of our burnouts and that we have this big guilt that we need to keep up with our main jobs while also doing 100 million other volunteer things. And the way you try to deal with it is trying to take some of the breaks at your job and try to re-energize or find additional energy, but it never works. Like you take a break and then you just double down on volunteering, and then by the end of this break you as exhausted as you were before, because there is no way you can just zoom out and detox or whatever it means. It's absolutely impossible to do.
You know, it's a fun exercise. This is not like a self-congratulatory exercise, but actually the opposite, because it's like, what the hell are you doing? Exercise. I once sat down and like wrote down all of the things I was doing in one day on a piece of paper, and I was like, shit, you need to slow down because you're not doing anything properly. You're just like all over the place and burning yourself out even further. But it was, yeah, quite enlightening to see that like it's like partially like a coping mechanism, right? To like do 3 million things at the same time.
Yeah, but it's also important to talk to fellow Ukrainians, because a lot of folks who are not Ukrainians and not in this situation, usually even if they're sympathetic, they're just, well, you got to, talk to a therapist, or here's like an article how to de-stress or decompress and everything else, and you look and go through it and it makes zero sense because your situation is really very specific, and some of the tips that are there are just unusable whatsoever. So, for example, I cannot detox from my phone because I cannot miss a single piece of information related to, well, at least my family, but also the country in general and whatnot. So, yeah, we got to figure out on our own how to deal with it, that's for sure. Today, we're continuing talking to journalists and Ukrainian journalists, because, I mean, we started some time ago with a day of journalists in Ukraine, and the last show was featuring Ukrainian journalists as well. And we decided that it's important to keep talking about it because over 3 months into this genocide, the work of Ukrainian journalists has never been more dangerous, but it's also a fantastic story of amazing resilience. And that's why we would like to share more of the voices of Ukrainian journalists. That's what we're going to do today. But Val, maybe you will introduce the show for folks who are just for the first time with us. And after that, we'll introduce our featured Ukrainian of today.
Yeah, let's do it. I was thinking of how to spice it up and change it up because it's the same every time, but maybe not today. I'll just keep with how we usually introduce our show, as it brings some form of familiarity to our everyday
Stable
lives.
normalcy.
Stability, yes. But essentially, for those of you who haven't heard of Ukrainian Spaces, it's a podcast that Maxim and I started that has grown into something, I guess, a little bit more than a podcast, but a community of Ukrainian voices, because we really saw that there was this sort of gap in the way that Ukraine was covered, both within sort of journalism and activism and everything related to the story of Ukraine. We saw millions of Ukrainians with perfect English sharing their stories and opinions across social media platforms, yet conversations about Ukraine continue still today until this day to be dominated by Western, mostly white and mostly male folks. And this essentially means that it continuously robs us Ukrainians of our agency and leads to the fact that there's a lot of outdated, misleading, and false narratives about our country. So what we want to do here is welcome Ukrainian voices, uplift Ukrainian voices, and foster a relaxed, safe, and chill space for us to express ourselves and for our featured guests to tell us more about what they feel and think and want others to learn about.
And Ukrainian Spaces is a live event on Twitter Spaces, but it's being automatically recorded and then uploaded as podcasts as well to Apple and Spotify. So if you by any chance miss the live event, and we love doing it live because it's messy, unfiltered, and beautiful. But anyway, you can always catch up with later on podcast platforms. Do not forget to comment and rate, because that's how those podcasts become trending on those platforms, and that's important for us as well. And also a good reminder that Ukrainian Spaces is 100% volunteer, independent, and listener-supported initiative. So it's important for us to have your support and financial support as well. Our Patreon page, which is called Ukrainian Spaces, is for you to check out. And we're super grateful for our patrons who support the show and make sure that we can do it better. We can keep continuing to do it. Andrei, are you with us?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, perfectly. Slava Ukraini.
Okay, yeah, I'm the worst user of Twitter for now, so this is like a very new experience, and I'm the first time I'm using Ukrainian Spaces and Twitter Spaces at all, so sorry if I mess this whole thing up and you'll have like a non-existent episode.
No, you definitely didn't. This is why it's a chill space for us to come together, because it's all fine. It's all okay.
But we also got on Twitter so many Ukrainians by now. I feel like Twitter should really pay us for all of this, because this is not the first time someone like you comes on. It's like, oh, this is the first time I'm using Twitter for the first time, or Twitter Spaces. Anyhow. Andrei, we have a golden rule for all our featured Ukrainians. We never introduce them and allow themselves to introduce the way they wanted to tell their story. So please tell everyone else who you are, where you come from, and how your life has been since genocide started.
So I am a CEO of Ukrainska Pravda, which is one of the biggest news websites in Ukraine. My job is more on the business and operations side, so I'm not exactly like a journalist or an editorial team member, although I have a big experience in journalism. I've been writing for many publications for the last 10 years. And also I work with local news as part of Media Development Foundation, which is a NGO working with independent local publishers in Ukraine. So these are like two areas of my professional interest, running Ukrainska Pravda and helping independent local publishers in Ukraine grow and build sustainable operations, which is kind of hard. So speaking about the last 3 months, I've been living in Chernivtsi, with my family. Me and my wife originally come from Mykolaiv, which is the southern Ukraine. And right now it's like a heavily shelled region, and a lot of my relatives had to move, and both of our parents are here with us. So we like set up a hub, both a professional hub for journalists in Chernivtsi with Media Development Foundation, and on a personal level, I moved like a big chunk of my family here as well. And for now, we are here.
Ukrainska Pravda, as a newsroom, has so much legacy for Ukrainian journalism. It's basically integral with the with the name of Ukrainian journalism in general. It was founded by Georgi Gongadze, who was murdered by Ukrainian authorities for his work and became the symbol of Ukrainian journalism, and actually the person who I, you know, because of him, I became a journalist as well. So just a bit of background context, you're also now privileged to get a taste of Ukrainska Pravda journalism, because they, at least for now, for a moment, they also publish stuff in English. So that's important for you, everyone, to check out as well. So yeah.
Okay, it's been... don't worry. I'll let you let it all out, and I'll come in after. But I was just gonna say, it's been like one of my main in English news sources on Telegram. The Ukrainska Pravda in English Telegram channel has been awesome at keeping me updated on a daily basis. But Andrey, I wanted to ask you. I think it's clear, and we've never seen this before, this unprecedented level of media coverage on Ukraine. Everything from ranging from the war to our culture to everything you can think about on Ukraine and from across the world, from, you know, West, non-West, you know, everywhere around the world is covering a lot of stuff about Ukraine. But I wanted to ask your opinion about, what do you think right now is the particular role of Ukrainian journalists and perhaps Ukrainian on the ground journalists in sort of shaping the media landscape and the narrative around our country?
Well, I think that, like, on the surface level, it's first of all, like, reporting the verified information, which may sound trivial, but or like obvious, but I think that in terms of like the amount of information that's being published right now about Ukraine, it's vital to continue like fact-checking and publishing the verified information, which we our team has doubled down on. I think that we never like differentiate between the Ukrainian audience and international audience. And we've launched, like, in the first day of war, we've launched the English feed, which was not like on the business plan or anything. We haven't planned to do it this year, at least, although we discussed it, and this wasn't the plan. So this was like a very, you know, ad hoc decision. And I don't think that the editorial team is thinking too much on whether like this or that actually shapes any narrative at all. So we, our news team and the editorial team and on the whole, is like dedicated to, you know, doing their job and publishing the verified and up-to-date information. So I think that it's been like a sort of like on the personal level, it's been a sort of a way to cope with the pressure of living in the war torn Ukraine. For me, like, to stick to the to actual job that needs to be done, like to stick to the daily tasks.
I think it's so important, because I think a lot of the time, even like foreign journalists forget that without Ukrainian journalists, the verified on the ground factual information would not be there, you know? And I think that's just so important to keep talking about and highlighting, because we just will forget and people will start writing opinion pieces without actually reporting and keeping to some of the principles of journalism that we had always.
And Ukraine is so large, and people always forget that to cover everything that is happening all across the country, notwithstanding the situation on the front line, you need literally thousands and thousands of journalists just to regularly document it, all the horrors, all the war crimes that are happening, and just all the damage that the country is experiencing. But this leads me to my question to you, Andrei, about the reality of a Ukrainian newsroom surviving through all of this. Because, you know, if you just scroll through social media feeds and websites, you kind of see that newsrooms are have never been more busier, Ukrainian newsrooms, and the amount of work is insane. However, what you don't see as a user, as a reader, as an audience, is what a horrible and massive impact genocide and the war has on Ukrainian newsrooms in terms of, I don't know, impact on relocation. Some of the newsrooms had to find new place to work. Some, you know, people just spread out all over Europe or Ukraine. So can you please maybe give us kind of a general idea what kind of impact Ukrainian newsrooms are experiencing before because of the genocide, and how it is changing the way they need to operate these days?
Yeah, the impact is tremendous. I mean, unless the editorial team is like headquartered in the Western Ukraine, almost everyone else had to move, had to relocate, and the pressure on the teams, you know, to continue working and to relocate and to change your life has been tremendous. So I think that partially Ukrainska Pravda managed to do that was because in the days that preceded February 24, we received a lot of, you know, as many other, as the entire world, I think, we were discussing like what to do in case Russia attacks, and we decided to rent like temporary houses in the Western Ukraine, and we moved a small part of the news team there maybe several days before February 24, and that allowed us to, you know, sustain the news coverage while everyone else was moving, and we really managed to sustain the non-stop, like 24/7 news coverage, and we did that only because, like, we have been preparing, and of course because we have, like, I think the best news team in Ukraine, at least. So yeah, and also, like, what people don't see is that the business side, because Ukrainska Pravda is like a commercially driven publication, so we had to quickly change our economic model, and if it wasn't for the donor funding from international organizations, it would be very hard for us to last.
I mean, of course, Ukrainska Pravda is one of the most famous names of Ukrainian journalism, and many abroad know it. But, like, for example, I personally work with a lot of smaller local newsrooms on some occupied territories now, you know, from places like Mariupol, where they had to leave their homes behind. And when you look into those individual cases, of newsrooms struggling to just survive. This very important question of increased costs and where exactly our newsrooms, Ukrainian newsrooms, get hit the most. So, I mean, judging from Ukrainska Pravda experience, but also as you look around overall at Ukrainian newsrooms, where do you think the international help is most needed, and what positions, so to say, on the budget or in activities that our fellow Ukrainian journalists need the help with the most at the moment?
I think that, like, if we speaking about, like, the most needed areas, I think it's obviously the local publishers on the east and on the south of Ukraine. Because it's like, we, even before the war, it wasn't like a very vibrant media environment on the local, because like we didn't have a lot of, you know, successful local independent publishers. And right now it's devastating. It's we also work a lot with the local publishers from the east, from Donetsk, Lugansk, and you know, and Kharkiv and so on, and all these regions. And they are, most of them are relocated right now. And I think, well, they have much smaller budgets than Ukrainska Pravda, so it's easier to secure funding if they found like a program that suits them, or like a donor organization. But it's at least like from judging from the publishers that we work with at the Media Development Foundation, it's like over 50 publishers, and I mean publishers from the east and the south of Ukraine. Most of them are on the city or town level, and they are hit very hard. Like their entire business model is devastated, and it won't come back, because if their their audience has moved, their business partners are either shut down or moved elsewhere, and it's very hard for them to sustain themselves other than find donor help. So I think that the local media industry in Ukraine needs help. And if you follow like the local media question globally, I think that like there is a direct relation between the local media and the communities, and the level of democracy on the local level. So the communities' voting rights and like the freedom of expression, freedom of doing business. So this is like tremendously important element of the local communities, and right now it's totally devastated.
News consumption, one of your threads talks about the shifts of sort of behavior of users and news consumption in Ukraine since the beginning of the war, and I was just wondering if you could speak a bit more about how that has changed and what that means as well for why this support of donors is so important for people actually on the ground in Ukraine.
For the last months, I think it has been like more or less stable, but it's much lower than we had in March, and significantly lower than in April. And everyone is having pretty much a similar picture, which on one hand is maybe not so good for the ad views that we monetize from, but on the other hand, it's good, I think, for this psychological, you know, health of mental health of our audience and journalists.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think also like a lot of the time when we get, because thinking about Western media as well, I'm sure that they've been really, it's a bad way of saying it, but like also benefiting probably in terms of views and whatnot from what's been happening in Ukraine in a big way. And probably a lot of mistakes that they've been making and so on and so forth has just been driven by this like hunger to continue getting those views and so on and so forth. Maybe that's a too pessimistic of a view. I'm just like getting PTSD from my time working in a newsroom that I shall not name. But anyway, I have a question for you a little bit sort of taking it away from Ukrainian journalism, and because this space is also for everyone to learn who's tuning in and joining us. What have been some unhelpful behaviors of Western media that you've seen, and unhelpful for, I guess, Ukrainian media and just Ukraine in general? And what would you sort of ask them to do differently if you could?
Well, I can't call myself like a very, you know, big follower of the Western media in terms of like the narrative on Ukraine. Speaking about the unhelpful behavior, I think that, like, from what I saw, and I'm like a media studies nerd, and I'm not like reading the news like the general audience reads. So what I read is mostly like the Nieman Lab and the media focused publications. And in the first months of war, I think that I was very disgruntled by the way that the different publications described the Ukrainian media environment and the what the Ukrainian journalists are what the journalists are doing in Ukraine without ever mentioning any Ukrainian journalists. And there was like a lot of these publications like speaking about how hard it is to report about the war and how dangerous it is for journalists. And it was most of these texts only mentioned the international journalists or foreign correspondents working in Ukraine, like from big publications like New York Times or Washington Post. And not mentioning like hundreds of journalists who risk their lives working in Ukraine. And this felt like super colonial to me, and which is to say that I'm not like a, you know, colonialism has not been like a field that I was particularly interested in. And I know that it's like Maxim's big area of interest, but it wasn't for me that way, but it certainly is now. So I think that keeping Ukrainian professionals out of the spotlight is like the biggest thing that should have been done better. And I have to say that it is done a bit better right now. So we see that our journalists are getting some attention right now, but still it's very, very colonial. It remains very colonial to me.
Yeah, representation. Thank you so much for raising this. We've all journalists we spoke on this show before. This is a constant topic. And I think that's why actually Ukrainian journalists are so qualified to talk about colonialism, not only Russian colonialism, but also the Western colonial gaze that we face. Because as Ukrainian journalists, especially journalists who work in English or foreign audiences, that's been our experiences for many years, where our expertise and our professionalism would be always rated as second grade type of professionalism, and our analysis or expertise would be less of a value. Topic that we all are super frustrated as Ukrainian journalists, and it's the failure of American and Western big tech when it comes to Ukrainian journalism. And I know that you constantly, prolifically speak out about it, and I'm really grateful for you for that work that you do about how exactly big tech not only is not helpful when it comes to Ukrainian journalists, but actually hurts and censors Ukrainian journalism in a way. So can you please also share with everyone else, especially those who might be hearing for the first time about this problem, how exactly it manifests on the ground in Ukraine?
I come like from the media distribution background, so I'm like a SMM geek of sorts, and I have like all the tools that and experience to analyze the stuff that's happening on different platforms, and that's like my hobby of sorts. And in the months since the war came into this active phase, I've been researching how the big tech, first of all, how the big tech enabled the Russian propaganda globally, which is crazy. And I'm actually like surprised that no one is writing about that, like on the, in the, you know, big publications. And I don't feel that the amount of attention that that my work received is like enough for this topic to be covered. And but anyways, I researched how like the growth of Russia Today and Sputnik and all the big Russian propaganda media outlets on the platforms on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and it's been crazy. And for like 10 years or dozens of years before February 24, these outlets received like massive amounts of engagement and views and followers, and no one actually paid any attention. And it's crazy because like if you install VPN and go to Russia Today, I mean, if you are in Ukraine and install VPN, because I think Russia Today is available for the US and UK audience. But if you go to Russia Today and like search for the content that they published in 2014, 2015, and it's like it's almost the same level of bullshit that they are publishing now, and no one was paying attention to that. And just because they were spending millions on to promote themselves on the big tech platforms, they got like VIP support, and they it allowed them to grow. And in the like in the months since the war started, I think like by end of March, most of them have been restricted on these platforms. But even in like early March, the Russian state-owned channel Russia One on YouTube received like hundreds of millions of views per week, and was according to a very, you know, authoritative leaderboards called Tubular Labs, which is like a service to analyze YouTube. They were the number one channel in the news and politics category globally. So, and they were, they stayed at this position in the top three, I guess, for like a year before the war. So it was, it's crazy how they allowed all that to happen and were, and needed like a real genocide to happen to restrict these channels. And yeah. And in the like last months, I checked again, and it was crazy to know that they still, Russia Today and Sputnik still manages to get hundreds of thousands of social interactions, like likes, shares, and comments on Facebook and Instagram, even after the ban, just because it wasn't entirely banned globally. It was just restricted, and you still can publish publish content. They still can publish content, and you can still, if you like, if a person is a, you know, pro Russia Today or pro Putin, he or she can still post this content on Facebook without any restrictions.
Yeah. And, you know, they even had like in South America, I think Russia Today Espanol was like a massive, massive sort of niche that they filled on digital channels. As you're saying, it was like, I think it wasn't like amongst the top digital media. I don't even want to call them media, but you know what I mean? It was like the top in terms of people's news consumption for a very long time, because there was no sort of, I mean, they're, not that there was none, but they were like the biggest and the most financially backed media publisher in South America. And that's why we're seeing a lot of sort of misinformation right now coming back to bite us in that space as well.
And the, in the way that they cracked down on English versions, but then left out any local language versions of the same outlets, say in Arabic or Espanol, is another illustration that what big tech is doing when they present this effort to deplatform Kremlin is more of a damage control situation for the APR rather than actual honest effort to deplatform Russian propaganda, and something that we've been asking them to do for years. And part of the responsibility, unfortunately, for the ongoing genocide is on American big tech that failed us at deplatforming genocidal propaganda, hate speech, and Russian state-made propaganda for many years, for almost a decade.
Yeah, it's not their first genocide on their hands, though, either, so...
Absolutely. But wanted to ask a follow-up, Andrei, about the same kind of toxic inability of American big tech to amplify independent journalism, which is unfortunately not a very unique Ukrainian situation. As a person who works with a larger region, I know that it's endemic everywhere. But specifically for Ukrainian newsrooms, I think that in recent years, but since the genocide as well, we've seen how big tech social media platform algorithms are actively censoring the work of Ukrainian journalism and journalists, and also limit their ability to promote their work, just for the simple reason that those companies never paid even attention for whitelisting Ukrainian newsrooms in the first place. So how bad the situation it is right now for Ukrainian journalists trying to get the word out and their work trending on social media platforms?
In terms of like getting the word out and getting like attention on Facebook, I think that the situation is not really bad, because in most of the times, like we big publications managed to grow their pages, and I mean, even Ukrainska Pravda got like plus 200,000 followers in this for the last couple of months. But in terms of like the whitelisting and the general policies, it's very, very bad, and I don't think that there is even an intention to do that from Facebook, because we've been participating in several meetings. I mean, we, the Ukrainian publishers, they've been trying to talk to us, but most of the times, like these talks, they were useless. And even though we like came prepared and we asked, concrete questions, it looks like nothing is going to be done in this regard. And expecting for them to whitelist independent Ukrainian publishers, for me, and I've been like following Facebook since like for the last 10 years or so, I think that's expecting too much. So I wasn't even expecting that, but at least setting up like some quick response team to work with the Ukrainian publishers on a more like quick reaction basis is something that they could have done, and they totally have the resource to do that. And
we don't even have a phone number or an email to write when some critical situation happens, especially when it comes to security of journalists and online security and organized attacks on Ukrainian newsrooms online, which happens basically every day.
Yeah, well we have, so I have such an email, but we have like a couple of emails that are like passed around as, you know, this piece of sacred knowledge from generation to generation. So we recently had like a local conference here in Chernivtsi. We set it up like for the local and for the national media in Ukraine, and we did a panel on what platforms are doing and what they should do. And I joked that there's this guy from Poland who is like a manager for the region, and everyone knows this guy. So like I will not like say his name, maybe for some, you know, safety reasons, but there is like a person who is in charge of entire like media partnerships for the region, and his email is like oh, you emailed him? Yeah, I did. And that's like the only thing that you can do. And he's good. He's actually like, he's been helping us a lot, but that's like one person. And yeah,
we can expect to take care of the country of 40 million with thousands of newsrooms with their daily needs.
And for instance, like one of the big issues that we tried to solve at Media Development Foundation is that if you are a publisher from Donetsk or Luhansk region, you cannot promote your page. So it's like your ad account on Facebook and Google is restricted. So I emailed them this and said that, guys, this, we have to do something about that, because we fundraise for the local media and there is a budget that we can spend on helping them reach a bigger audience, and we cannot do this. And they don't have the resource to work with the local media. So
absolutely,
they can only work like with the biggest publishers. And I'm happy to be like one of these publishers, but it's not, it's like 1% of what can be done in this situation.
And so should
very,
be done.
And I'm very disappointed in what, you know, Facebook and Google does.
Yeah, well, another issue, just an example that we faced with so many Ukrainian newsrooms, but also in general in the region, even before the genocide and the war, a full-scale invasion started, that some of the topics were banned from promotion, like, for example, topics that mentioned Russia or Ukraine, or topics that mentioned military warfare, just because of the, on the background of buildup and more active Russian propaganda algorithms were trained to kind of censor those topics and ban them from promotion and boosts. And that was a horrible situation for many newsrooms unable to get their journalism out, especially the smaller newsrooms, independent newsrooms as well. And it's still to the date is not fixed at all.
Yeah.
Anyway,
as we speak right now, our page, like the main page of Ukrainska Pravda on Facebook, is restricted. So we received like a strike, even maybe a series of strikes on Facebook for publishing war-related content. And one of the latest strikes that got our page, the organic reach of our page, decreased tenfold. Is for publishing a cartoon by a Ukrainian artist that depicted Putin being decapitated by a tank. So it's like a cartoon, and obviously it was like we had a series of artworks by Ukrainian artists about the war, and so it's been a week of limited organic reach. And I've been emailing my Polish contact from Facebook, and and so far nothing has been done. So Ukrainska Pravda.
And this is, folks, the largest independent newsrooms in Ukraine. So you can imagine what much smaller newsrooms face on an everyday basis. And they will have to wrap up, unfortunately. Although this is so cool, and we can talk so much more about all these issues, but. Before we finish with our favorite question, I wanted to ask a very quick one on a personal level, because that's where we started with burnout. And I know that Ukrainian journalists and, you know, media managers and everybody who's involved in this effort of making truth while you're about Ukraine are feeling it on very profound way. So personally, how you've been dealing with that? I mean, how much of an issue for you, and whether you ever figure out the ways how to battle it in a more effective way?
Well, I thought about that, and I'm thinking about that quite a lot, but I think that I've been seeing on Twitter and on Facebook in the last 3 months a lot of people cite this book by Viktor Frankl, In Search of the Meaning, like by the person who survived the Nazi camp. And one of the things that he wrote about, which it's a very good book, and I advise everyone to read it. It's almost surely available in English. And one of the things that he wrote about is that to cope with the pressure of living in the horrible environment, it really helped him and other people to focus on the job, like to focus on the daily tasks and just do them. So this, I guess, like this has been like a solution for me, because in general I consider myself a lucky person. I mean, I still have my job, and I actually like I have more work to do now as opposed to millions of Ukrainians losing their jobs and having no means to sustain themselves and their families. And also, like, even though my family and my closest relatives are still in Mykolaiv and it's being bombed on the daily basis, but all of them are fine and no one is hurt, and most of them are safe in the safe areas. So my biggest concern right now is whether my 7-year-old son will go to school this year in Chernivtsi or Kyiv, because I'm like that what concerns me like a lot, and the rest is like I'm focused on Ukrainska Pravda and the local news, and I'm not thinking a lot about anything else. So I think that has been a solution for me, and I know that for a lot of people, spending too much time on like focused, locked on the news feed has been you know, worsening their condition and has been like a psychological stress. And it may sound counterintuitive from like a news guy to say to actually recommend reading less news, but I think that's what I will say. And
I think you've just been prepared for it earlier than everyone else. You've been forced to intensively consume news for a while now just because of what you do. So I think it's great to recommend this to everyone else. Before we finish, we only have a couple of minutes, but this is a question we ask everyone. And I see that loads of our previous guests are also here, which is always great to see. It feels like almost a family. But the whole point of Ukrainian Spaces is that we want to show the breadth of Ukrainian voices, opinions, and things like that. And so we wanted to ask you, what does it mean to be Ukrainian to you personally?
It's like a very, very easy and a very hard question for the last minute of the talk. What is it to be like? I think that the easiest answer will be like to be a Ukrainian is to be free and independent. I think that we have shown like for the last 10 years, we have shown that we, and maybe for the last 20 years, we are showing that we are a free and democratic state. We have free elections and we have free market, and we can be independent, and we can even, you know, fight the country that several times larger than us, and we can be like a wall to the entire Western world in this scenario. So to be free and independent, it's being a Ukrainian for me.
God, Ukrainians always answer questions on identity the best. Literally, I haven't heard a single bad answer or like meh answer. It's always something. I mean, of course, the times are emotional, but it always moves me. And I know for a fact that those are non-Ukrainians listening to us, every time they hear the answer, it's just, you know, goosebumps. So thank you, Andrei. Thank you so much for spending this time with us and joining us. And You're part of Ukrainian Spaces family now, so you're welcome to return, and we would love to host you as well and to talk on the topics you want to amplify. And that was quite a pleasure hosting you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you.
Yep. So this is all for now. Ukrainian Spaces hashtag, please. Guys, super encourage you to claim it and to share your experiences as if you are Ukrainians, if you want them to amplify that. We always happy to quote them and to reshare. But also don't forget that this exists as a podcast, and we need your help not only listening and sharing them, but also rate and comment them. That will help. And for our Patreon sponsors, thank you so much. This hour has been possible because of your support. And we're super grateful for having it. But again, if you are one of those listeners who maybe joined the show for the first time, or you feel constantly frustration with the way Ukrainian voices are not being represented and the way Ukraine is miscovered abroad, there is a simple solution. Just channel your frustration and rage in supporting Ukrainian Spaces, donating, you know, as little as possible. That will all make sure that Ukrainian voices trend. So that's it, apart from probably one thing, which is Slava Ukraini.
Hello, I'm Slava, and see you next time.
Okay, guys, bye.